This pot smells delicious, and it's the base for our ultimate beef stew. Now we're talking about beef stew.
Beef stew.
Try this
beef stew.
Try this
beef stew.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Once again, welcome to Beef Stew Radio every Thursday at 11:30 p.m. I am your host, Beef Stew. I'm in the building. And you know I got my co-host with me, the capper. He's on the side, beating it down. But today, ladies and gentlemen, we got a great guest on the show for y'all today. We have today in the building, we have the author of the new book that's out called The Infiltrator, and he's also ex-federal government agent, Mr. Robert Mazur. How you doing, sir? Welcome to the show.
I'm doing fine. Thank you very much.
Now, we're going to get right into it, Mr. Mazur. I want to ask you, how did you start, as a federal agent, FBI agent?
Well, it was totally by accident. It was the early 1970s. I was in college. It was bad economic times like it is now, and I needed to get a job. I needed to work on weekends, and I needed to work a little bit during the week in order to pay the bills. So I went to the jobs board, and I saw this advertisement for a position as a co-op student with what was called the Intelligence Division of the IRS. I had no idea what that was, And so I found out that these were the guys who were that helped put Al Capone behind, or really were responsible for putting Al Capone behind bars. They're the accountants who worked with the FBI and other agencies to do the forensic accounting work that put the big, complicated white collar cases together. And so I started working with them. After a period of time, I transferred to other agencies and ultimately to the Drug Enforcement Administration, where I did a lot of my undercover work.
Now, how did you manage to stay undercover for 5 years without anybody, finding out? And I know that's a risky business. How did you manage to do that?
Yeah, it's a very long process. First, I went through training. I had to go through an undercover school, two schools actually, where they vet you and make sure that at least they try to make sure that you're going to be capable of handling the mental and physical stress that's going to go along with living a double life. I mean, I walked away from my real life and walked into another and lived it 24/7. After I got through the schools, I had about a year and a half to put together a sophisticated front. And in this particular case, it needed to be a believable money launderer. And when you do long-term undercover, you don't want to go too far outside of what your roots are all about. I'm an Italian-American from New York, and so that's what the identity was going to be. I had experience in accounting and from banking, and so I needed to have that incorporated in there. And with the help of about a half dozen informants and concerned citizens, I emerged about a year and a half into putting the front together as an active member of a series of businesses. It was an investment company in Florida, a mortgage business in Florida, air charter service with a private jet that ran from Florida to the Bahamas, and a jewelry chain with about 70 locations on the East Coast, and even a brokerage firm with a seat on the New York Stock Exchange. So that, coupled with the endorsement of two guys associated with one of the five crime families in New York, that was pretty much my bona fides. I put my gun and my badge away, and I used my false identity as my protection. I spent 2 years then climbing the ladder of the Medellin cartel and working my way up ultimately to some of the people who were direct reports to Pablo Escobar, his consigliere, a lawyer out of Medellin, Colombia, who everybody thought was a professor at the university and a practicing lawyer, and he dealt with the legislature, but he was actually a planner of global money laundering schemes. And this is the kind of guy who would sit on a committee that would decide who would live and die on a given day. So those were the kind of people that I ultimately dealt with. I also became a conduit for them to the international banks and businesses, corrupt ones that are involved in laundering hundreds of billions of dollars a year that come from the drug trade. And so I wound up infiltrating what was then the seventh largest privately held bank in the world, a bank called Bank of Credit and Commerce International, had branches in 72 countries, more than 15,000 employees, and their board included a considerable number of people who were in the market of taking in as many deposits, no matter how much blood or dirt was on the money, and they knowingly took drug proceeds in, and so through the undercover work, not only did we wind up putting about 100 drug dealers and money launderers away, we wound up seizing about 3,200 pounds of coke, about 100 million in cash and assets, about 500 million in fines, and took down the bank and put it out of business, and put a lot of the bank officers behind bars.
So you had to live a life like, you know, you lived a life not like any average, you know, agent. You know, you had to live like a trillionaire or billionaire's life. How was that? You know, how did you not get caught up in that and to keep focus on, you know, your case?
Yeah, you know, you can get caught up in that. You make a great point, because one of the things that you'll feel when you do this type of undercover work is what I call the pull. I mean, if you've got to keep yourself grounded, you've got to remember where you came from and why you're there, and you have to be completely diligent on collecting evidence. I mean, I and my partner recorded about 1,200 recordings with these guys, and so at the end of the night, when I'm done at 3 o'clock in the morning dealing with them, I've still got to put a couple of hours in processing the evidence and hiding it in safes that were in the house and then ultimately at times meeting my contact agent to pass this stuff off and calling into the office and making sure that they knew what was going on. But I got, you know, bad guys would do it and they would be real careful about how they talked amongst themselves because they didn't want the cops to hear them on the phones. So I would be in the exact opposite. You know, I didn't want the guys that I was working with to know that I was calling the cops. So you're really doing the same kind of thing, just a little bit of a twist of who you're trying to hide your tracks from. And the good thing about this operation was, yeah, I did live a very high lifestyle, but it didn't cost the taxpayers one dime. We're authorized to use the profits from the undercover operation to defray the costs. So the costs were all paid from the profits of dealing with the people who ultimately we put in jail. I had access to a private jet, and I, you know, drove a Mercedes and a Rolls Royce, and, you know, partied at a lot of different clubs in Miami and New York and London and Paris, and I flew all over the world. But that's the way those people live, and that's the way those operations are carried out. These are people who do not like what Hollywood paints them on the movies. I mean, they're not Scarface. These are people who speak 3 and 4 languages. They're very well educated, doctors, lawyers, corporate execs. They're the people in the shadows that pull all the strings that make the Scarfaces of the world do what they do.
So did you like? Now, when you bring down these people, you do a 5-year investigation, you have to play undercover and become friends with these guys. Do you ever have any feelings with anybody at the end of an investigation?
Well, you know, and I try to address this in the book. I'm not really capable of being able to not like a guy and act like I like a guy. if we're going to become friends, there's a part of me that truly does make that bond with them. And you've got to do that. You've got to kind of almost fake yourself out into playing that role and becoming that concerned friend. I mean, these are people that, and it's really, some people don't realize the wear and tear and the pain that it creates for the operative like me. In some instances, you know, I knew these people's family. Their families weren't involved in this stuff. You know, I knew the kids. I knew the moms. I was a friend. I was somebody they turned to when times were bad. I mean, we had a month left before the undercover operation was over, and one of the traffickers who kind of took me under his wing had given me so much information. I knew precisely where a shipment of more than a ton of coke was coming into the New York area, and I passed that information on. The feds set up on it, followed it into a warehouse in Chelsea in downtown Manhattan, and took it off with that guy. And so his wife visited him, and I thought for sure that, you know, because there were only a handful of people who really knew all the details, I thought for sure I was going to be suspected. And after about 3 or 4 days, she called me and said that his name was Roberto. He said, Roberto has a message for you. And I was wondering how bad a message it was going to be. But she said, you know, he's decided you're the only one he can trust, so he wants you to take over his responsibility and collect from the distributors and pay the suppliers. So I wound up actually moving into his role in the last 30 days before the end of the operation. They're definitely, when it all went down, I had to do a lot of soul searching, because, you know, I had committed some of the same crimes that these guys had committed, and, you know, I'm going to be a hero in the eyes of some. I'm not a hero. You know, I'm just trying to do my job. But in another way, these guys are going to go to prison for a good part of their lives, and I did the same thing they did. But I had to, in order to be able to collect that evidence. And in the operation that is in the book, which is about the first half of my undercover life, that operation was ended with we try to figure out how we're going to get people from Pakistan and from Colombia and from the UK and France and all over the U.S. into one spot so we can make the arrests. And what we ultimately decided was that they appeared to like me and another of the undercover agents so much that we just staged a fake wedding. Mm-hmm. And we rented the whole deal at a country club, just like it was really going to happen. You know, big tent for 250 people, flew them all in, and they all came with their gifts. And the night before, there was supposed to be a bachelor party. And each guy got into a limo with other people he thought were family and friends who were there for the wedding, and they in fact became the arrest teams for those guys. And wow. And each were taken off in their own limos, and about a half an hour later they were all arrested. And even when they were arrested, they didn't believe it. one of the guys said, you know, I've been to a bachelor party like this before where the women dress up like cops, and, you know, so for the women, he thought it was part of a stag party. He didn't. He still couldn't believe it was really an undercover operation.
Well, once again, folks, you listen to Beef Stew Radio. I'm your host, Big Stew. We're talking to Robert Mazar, the author of The Infiltrator, and, you know, this story is real deep. Now, you know, I got to ask you this next question is probably like a two-part question. It's I want to know, you know, how many times your life came under fire, and, you know, how did that affect your family life? You know, how did it affect your home, your wife, your kids with all this pressure?
Yeah. There were some close calls. Actually, not long after I really started to meet some of the heavy guys, I was in the lobby of the Helmsley Palace in Manhattan, and the main bad guy, the main distributor, I was with him, and his bodyguard was outside in the car packing heat, and as we're in the lobby waiting for one of the other undercover agents to come to the lobby, I heard somebody yell out my name from the other side of the lobby, and I looked up. Well, I had worked undercover before this. I'd played the role of an accountant with it, you know, the money guy, keeping the records in a coke organization, and we took down an attorney and an accountant who were money launderers, and a whole international marijuana organization that they were laundering money for. But one of the accountant who had been prosecuted was a guy who cooperated, and we did everything we could to get him a lesser sentence. He wound up getting 5 years, and that was light compared to what he would otherwise faced. And I looked up, and lo and behold, it was him. He had gotten out of jail and was now back in, you know, trying to, I guess, work. And I turned to the Columbia next to me, and I just said, oh, gee, an old friend, just wait here, I'll be right back. And I walked as fast as I could on the other, to the other side of the lobby, and I just had enough time to embrace him and whisper in his ear, Charlie, I'm under again. And I had no idea what he was going to say, and it was too late. Everybody else was around me now. And I could feel a cold bead of sweat go down my back as I was waiting to hear him say whatever he was going to say. And luckily he played along. He said, you know, hey, the guys in Vegas haven't seen you in a while. You're working too hard, and he just came and made something up. And later he actually helped us in the operation. And he could have definitely outed me right there, and that would have been over. But there were other times too. I mean, unfortunately, we're cops, so you got to do surveillances. There would be times when people would be dropping off $1 million, $2 million in cash at a time.
Wow.
In cities throughout the United States. And the people who come and drop that money off are of great interest to the local office. And this happened to have occurred in New York. The guy came with like $1 million, and they wanted to follow him back, thinking that they would take him to a stash house where they would have money or drugs. And I always used to beg them not to do that. I mean, not to stay tight on these guys, because there's counter surveillance. The Colombian organizations would put people out there to watch and see if there were cops around. And a lot of this money that they were giving me, I wasn't just laundering it and sending it out into the air. I convinced them to let me invest the money. So some of the money. So I would put it in. You know, I had it in CDs. I put it into a construction company for the building of an apartment complex in downtown LA. They were in businesses. I mean, we even through these guys were fight promoters as well, and promoted a world class, you know, a world championship fight in Miami Beach with some of the money. So we could get this money and seize it later. And following these guys around and getting surveillances burned could definitely cost me my life. And unfortunately, they did identify on a couple of occasions that they were being followed. And I had meetings at times when I was sitting there, and I remember it very well. One time when I was accused of being a DEA undercover agent, and you just got to talk your way out of it, you know. You got to not act like a cop. If it's a situation where if you're really a bad guy, if you're really running this kind of stuff, if you heard that there had been some surveillance out there, the first thing you would do would be to shut down your operations, not take any more money, and try to figure out where the problems are before you do anything else. If you're a cop, you'll try to say, well, you know, who you to accuse me, and get a, you know, push, you know, get pushback. So I tried to do as much as I could to not act like a cop, and that probably some of my street instincts. I grew up in New York, and in the beginning of my book, I talk about the fact that my grandfather used to be part of a crew that worked for Lucky Luciano in New York. So I mean, I used to be around these people, and I think I know a little bit more than the average guy about how criminals act, and I think that was a big help to me in doing that. Plus, I had a wonderful partner, a guy from Puerto Rico who's an agent, Amir Abreu. I'd say Amir's probably the most gifted undercover agent that I have ever had the pleasure to work with, and he played the street thug, and he played it well. I couldn't have played his part. He couldn't have played mine. We made a good team, and between the two of us, I think that's really what kept the thing afloat in the midst of all kinds of potential problems with the traffickers. On your second question about home life, yeah, you know, if it wasn't for the fact, I had some real advantages here. I had family that lived in the close proximity of where my wife and two children continued to live. I mean, I would come home for a day or two, you know, after a month being out. But even that day or two, my mind was so much on that other life that I really wasn't the husband or the father that I should have been. My wife had her own profession, which was good. She's an educator. She's a first grade teacher. And she had her hands full, being both the mom and the dad. So she was pretty much too busy to sit around and worry about things. But we also, you know, we met in high school. We've been best friends for eons, and that was a big help as well. But a real big help was the fact that my family lived in the immediate area, and they could help and fill in the void and help her when I couldn't be around. So
because, you know, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. But
okay.
The question I have about that is because to do that type of under investigation, you know, you might have to, like, you know, do things that even might even compromise your wedding vows, you know, not to get the blow under your cover. Have you even got that close under investigation?
No, you know, in this role, I had an advantage here because I was supposed to be a mob-connected money launderer who was working for his family in New York. And my story to them simply was that, hey, because of my partner, real name Amir Abreu, who was my street manager, who educated me about the opportunities of making money with Latin America, I was given the authority to handle some of this money. And so I always would tell them, you know, I am not going to do anything to jeopardize my principal responsibilities. And that if anybody ever got the impression that I was out of control, and I was in meetings where people were out of control, and I was there when somebody's death was ordered. A guy who was drinking a lot, he had some very attention-grabbing mannerisms about him. He was bisexual, so, I mean, and he would make a big scene. At times when we're out in a social environment, they don't like that kind of stuff. I mean, these are people who expect you to act like a corporate executive. These guys could have run a Fortune 500 company if they wanted to, if they wanted to be legit. They just happen to have a different kind of product. It costs them $500 to make a kilo and about $2,500 to move it into the U.S. And, you know, they've got some expenses for personnel, but they're making 13 grand or so on every kilo they sell, and they were bringing in tons, and they still do that today. And this is one of my clients alone, just one client in his organization, they had $20 million a month available in 8 different cities every single month. So 160 million bucks, that's a lot of money, and they're not looking for anybody to be loose and reckless. If you're playing a lower level, street level, or a distributor type thing, you know, you're probably going to have more of that type of a problem or challenge than I did. So nobody used drugs. I mean, the only guy that did use drugs was the guy I was talking about before, who was drawing a lot of attention. And the only reason that he continued to be in the group is he was the grandson of the president of Colombia. So he got a little bit of a pass, but ultimately they decided that he was drawing way too much attention. The way they dealt with problems was terminal. I mean, my principal client was caught by Pablo Escobar stealing money. And what he did is he summoned this guy, Gerardo Moncada, summoned him and his brother before Escobar. And they hung these guys by their feet, stripped their clothes off, and used blow torches to melt the skin off their body. So they killed them.
Wow.
It's a totally different world, a completely different world, and it's big business. I mean, it generates $400 billion a year around the globe, $65 billion just in the United States every year. So it's
wow. Now, Robert, I'm sorry, this is Cap. Let me ask you, being that you've brought down a lot of these banks, and I'm pretty sure it hit the news and enough people were aware that this is happening, at least on the side of the bankers or people who are potentially being corrupt bankers, are there still banks that are willing to take these risks to launder money for these cartels?
Absolutely, and they do it in a very artful way. I got the opportunity to be face to face with these with some of these bankers. The bankers I talked with explained to me that they didn't learn this at the bank they were at. They learned it as they came through their career at different banks. I mean, some of them worked for Bank of America, some of them worked for Royal Bank of Canada. They ultimately came to BCCI and they used the best of the best talents that they saw out there. It was their perception. They said this before they were arrested, and they told me it afterward. I mean, I was involved in debriefing the bankers, one banker for a month, and the other one for about 2 weeks. And their position was, we don't understand. You know, we're not doing anything different than anybody else in the international banking community. There are within the international banks, and I'm not talking about the banks on the corner where we have our savings and checking accounts, because I think domestically in the United States, those banks really do have meaningful anti-money laundering compliance programs. They file forms that they're supposed to file. They report cash transactions, all that stuff. I'm talking about international banks, and when I say international, they could be a U.S.-based international bank, but they're involved in cross-border transactions. And I'll give you an example of a bank these banks are doing it today. Last year, Wachovia Bank entered into what's called a deferred prosecution. In my mind, that's legal speak for a slap on the wrist. What they did is they admitted to a criminal offense in connection with their receipt of roughly $400 billion in deposits from account holders in Mexico. This was during the years of 2004 through 2007. Among the services that they provided was the physical transportation of currency from Mexico back into the United States. And I say back because I can tell you from being in the business, a lot of that money was gathered on the streets of the United States, major cities, and then smuggled across our border south into Latin America. And then they move it oftentimes into houses of exchange, casas de cambio, in Mexico, and try to claim that this is cash that they've got because they've been exchanging cash legitimately. $400 billion represents one-third of the gross national product of Mexico for an entire year. The $14 billion in bulk currency that they brought back into the United States, if it was $20 bills, and I tell you it's 5, 10s, and 20s because that's what street money is, dope money is generally 5, 10s, and 20s, at least on the wholesale level. If it was just $20 bills, the $14 billion would have weighed 725 tons. I mean, who did they think they were getting 725 tons of cash from in Mexico? It doesn't take $1,000 an hour lawyer to tell you that you're dealing with something that's weird here. And the long and short of it is, unfortunately, that with respect to the Wachovia Bank matter and several others that have happened in the last 3 or 4 years, nobody, not one banker, went to jail. They paid a $160 million fine. You know, $160 million fine, that was 2% of their $12.3 billion profit. I don't think that's fair. One of the reasons that I was motivated to leave law enforcement was that I was not encouraged. They lost their focus at that time on working these types of cases, and they got more into the street violent type cases. And not that I condone what these two guys did, but I went to a sentencing. Two guys, they were barely out of their teens. One guy was 20, the other guy was 21. They sold crack, and they got hit the third time. I could have held in my two hands the amount of crack those guys were proven to have dealt in. They went to prison for life. Come on, man. $160 million fine, and then we got people who are going to prison for the rest of their lives. That's just not the way I want to see justice administered. And so since that time, I became very motivated to write this book to try to shine the light on the active involvement by a small segment, but a segment of the international banking and business community in marketing this money. I dealt with lots of different people in the legal world who buy and sell this currency. I was part of a black market money exchange, and these exist around the world. This is how it works. It's pretty simple.
We almost got to wrap up, so I just want you to wrap it up because the show.
All right, I'll wrap it up. Maybe some other day we'll talk about how that works.
No, because it's really interesting. So, I mean, I wanted to, you know, we got time, but, you know, I just wanted to let you know.
This is how it works. Supply and demand. You know, you want to have supply and demand equal to be a successful businessman. Who supplies me dollars? The drug traffickers do. Who demands dollars? Those are people who are importers who are in other countries. So if I'm an importer in Colombia and I want to buy a container load of refrigerators, I can't do it with Colombian pesos. I need dollars. That's what's on the international markets. So if I go to my own bank down in Colombia and I go to the Bank of the Republic, their Federal Reserve, it's worked through, I've got to pay prepaid taxes and duties. So I lose 25-30% of my money just exchanging it. If I go to the black market and go to a guy like me, I can buy it for 10%. So that's how a lot of this money actually gets exchanged and laundered. It's exchanged by drug traffickers' dollars being sold to importers, and the importers who have their local currencies wind up providing that to the broker like me, and then I get it to the drug dealer. As a broker, I can make 15% from the drug trafficker and 10% from the importer. So on a $1 million deal, I make $250,000. So
wow.
It's a big business.
I have one more question for you. The book is Infiltrator, My Secret Life Inside Dirty Banks Behind Pablo Escobar's Medellin Cartel. Now, I've read that you guys are in the works of making a movie. Just one question. Who do you picture playing you in the movie?
Wow. You know, I've been asked that question a lot. I don't know. I just hope that they make it, if we do get the opportunity to get all the way to it being really on the screen. I just hope it's as close to the book as it can be. As far as who could play me, you know, I don't know if you guys saw the movie The Departed.
I've seen that.
Okay. I thought Leonardo DiCaprio did a heck of a job on playing the role of the undercover agent in that one. So I know he can do it, but, you know, from my perspective, just as long as I'm hoping that it's going to be as honest to the book as it can be, and that's what I've been told by the director, who's very interested in this, and that we've closing this deal on, a guy by the name of Brad Furman, who did the movie The Lincoln Lawyer, that came out this past March, and I think he did a great job in that one. So we've got meetings in L.A. in January to start the process of working toward a screenplay, and the way that movie business goes is you got to get a really good screenplay, and once you've got that, you know, if you've got good talent that become interested in the screenplay, it becomes pretty easy to start getting the investors to put the money in, and they say they know how to do it, so we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, well, it's a real
it sounds real interesting.
It's going to work.
Yeah.
I hope so.
So once again, I want to thank you for being on our show. It's real, real interesting. I wish we had more time because it seems like, you know, so much is so in deep. But we want to thank Mr. Mazar for being on Beef Stew Radio once again on behalf of me and my partner, Kappa. You know, and you could tell anybody where they can get the book at real fast, you know.
Sure. There's a website, the-infiltrator.com, and you can find out where to buy it there. It's on Amazon.com, and a bunch of different places have it.
Okay. Once again, thank you, Mr. Mazar.
Well, thank you. I really do appreciate the invitation to be on your show, guys.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Once again, Beef Stew Radio, we do this every Thursday night. Make sure y'all get them pretty smiles in there. We still got the pretty smiles contest coming up. Remember, the deadline is December 26th. Hurry up and get them smiles on Facebook. All you got to do is click on to the Beef Stew Radio fan page, and you just put that smile in, and we'll get you. Next week, we'll be having pro wrestler manager, the sexy Amy Vitale. Yes, the sexy Amy Vitale. She's a pro wrestler manager. She's an actress. She's also a model, and we're going to be sitting here talking about things that she's doing, and she also got a comic book cap. You know, she got a comic book named after her. So, yeah, we're going to get down and talk to her about that. You got anything you want to say to people before we go, Mr. Capper?
I just want to say this was a deep interview. I mean, this guy, 5 years. I mean, what I would have liked to ask him was how did he, you know, how do you live life now, 5 years later? You're using the same name, but you can't show your face. Like, I really, we got to get him back on one day and find out.
Yeah, that's deep.
What, you know, how does that feel? Like, I mean, I'm just still trying to, you know, figure that one out.
He dealt with real money too. You know, you heard what he was saying. He dealt with real money, and he was living off the money. Like, he could just freely live off the drug dealer's money. So, you know, his life is exciting, and he still maintained not to compromise his vows to his wife, because, you know, that's hard, man. They throwing orgies at you. They throwing all type of stuff at you, Cap. And, you know, I'm going to be honest with you, Cap. I would have kept about $100,000 on the side for myself. You know what I'm saying? I don't know if he kept everything, huh? I don't know, but, you know, keep it real in the hood, I'd have kept a little $100,000. So his role was deep, man. I can't wait to see the movie, man.
Yeah. Well, the book is out. We're going to read the book, check the movie, and we went way over time, but it was
worth it. Yeah. So once again, we got to get up out of here. I'm sorry, Blog Talk, we love y'all. Once again, this is Beef Stew Radio. It's your man, Beef Stew. Check us out next week. We'll have the lovely and the gorgeous Amy Vitale, wrestling pro manager, actress, and model. And once again, I'm going to say good night on behalf of everybody. Have a good night. We're going to have the Christmas show next week. Peace.
This pot smells delicious, and it's the base for our ultimate beef stew. Now we're talking about beef stew.
Beef stew. Fry this beef. Fry this beef.